I've heard the name Jeremiah Tower a lot. Sir, I'm telling you, your reputation precedes you, and I like food. But first, I want to tell you about Roger Watson. He has a podcast that is amazing. This is a farming community boy from Illinois, and he's here helping farmers all across the country. And now he has a podcast all about farm to fork and how to make that great in our area. What I love about this community is everything is so fresh. I came here from Louisiana. The food is not fresh in Louisiana. It's good. It's delicious. It's not fresh. Your food is fresh, and that is amazing. Without further ado, Mr. Watson.
What an introduction. Hey, fantastic. Welcome. Thank you, Kirsten. Hey, and thank you, Jeremiah Tower. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you know what? Are you guys having as much fun as we are? Jeremiah,
can you believe this crowd? This is amazing. In Manhattan, this would be, you know, the kind of crowd. So I have it in Sacramento. It's just wonderful and staggering for me. And we wouldn't have that amazing building in the background. That is one of the best views I've ever seen.
There will be thousands of people here in this conversation. They're not all standing in front of us right now, but they can't see what we're seeing. How would you describe that?
Well, I'd say that it's more impressive than Washington, D.C. A lot more impressive.
Anybody else doing this?
Not like this. I mean, there is the farmers market in Santa Monica, which is about a hundredth this size, which is wonderful. No, I haven't seen a festival like this before anywhere.
You know, you mentioned the farmers market in Santa Monica. I like that farmers market. Do you know, I don't know if you've noticed, but when you go to that farmers market, they literally fly the flags for organic tents. Have you seen that?
Yes. Yeah. Amazing. I mean, Manhattan thinks they invented the farmers market, but actually the one in Santa Monica and the one I saw the other day here is much better.
Ah, that's great.
I wanted to move to Sacramento and start cooking. I was so impressed.
Anybody want him to move to Sacramento?
And the fruit.
That's a permanent guess.
You know, when I had Star, so in the 80s, Willie Brown would come in for lunch, have a couple of cocktails and say, Jeremiah, I've got to go back to Sacramento. Now, I'm sure he would say, Jeremiah, I live in Sacramento. Oh, my God, I have to go back to San Francisco. That's the difference.
You should live in Sacramento. And we'd like to have you in our neighborhood, and you can take care over the cooking for 4th of July and whatever.
Well, there you go. Thank you. But there's a new brasserie opening here in a few weeks.
You know, I want to go back to Santa Monica just for a second, though, because one other thing about that Santa Monica market, if you go to the middle of the market, they've got this stand where you can look up every single farmer and see all their farming practices. So if you went to a stand and you wanted to know what they use, what fertilizers and what in pesticides, they list them all.
That's one of the reasons it's so amazing. But, I mean, I think by the time you've done the full circuit here, you'd get the same education.
I know. You know, this brings us back to farmers. You get credited for being the father of California cuisine by many. And Kirsten's going to lead the charge there. I think we'll discuss your paternity here as to not only...
Do I have to take a DNA test?
Yeah, you do. You know, check DNA. See, are you really the father of California cuisine? There's a couple of competitors.
Well, there are lots of bastards in the story.
Well, you know, I think about the same time. I mean, James Beard was doing things. Alice Waters was doing some stuff, and you know. But there's only a couple that are even in contention, and I think you got the votes. But that's been expanded. Somewhere along the line, they started calling it California cuisine, and lately everybody's saying it's American cuisine. It's not limited to California. It's what's viewed as American cuisine now.
Well, you know, when I started as the executive chef of Chez Panisse in 1972, I tell people now when anyone asks me around the United States that everything that exists in Whole Foods, when you walk in there, nothing in Whole Foods that you could see today existed in those days. And I can see their eyes glaze over like you've got to be kidding me, right? But it's absolutely true. So when I started at Chez Panisse cooking and I looked around, I thought, you know, what can I get? And there wasn't much food around at all. I had to go to Oakland, in the heart of Oakland, to get olive oil. I had to go to Chinatown to get fish. There was almost nothing. There were no fresh herbs, nothing like that. And then Daryl Cordy came to Chez Panisse one night and said, Jeremiah, you've got to come to Sacramento. I think he said Sacramento Valley. Did they call it the Valley in those days? Yeah. And the Delta. And I'll show you where you're going to get all your things. So that was, 1973. And look what's happened here now. So Sacramento should be very proud of itself.
You forget about that. I mean, I did. That way back when, I mean, there wasn't such a thing. You had a hard time seeing the selection at the supermarkets, that the attention to fresh fruit and vegetables that there is right now. It started to happen in the restaurants. Were the supermarkets watching, and then that kind of led to seeing this in the supermarkets?
Well, but, people would come to Chez Panisse and say, I mean, it all started, foraging started in 1972 when a fisherman, a guy who worked the fishing boat coming back into San Francisco, and they were allowed to keep whatever they caught, and he came and had a huge salmon in his arms, and I said, anything you catch in the San Francisco Bay, bring it to me and I'll buy it. The next day he brought a wolf eel, which I had never seen before and had no clue what to do with, but I bought it and we made bouillabaisse. And then all the hippies with mushrooms from the Berkeley Hills started coming in. We raised geese up here in Sacramento to make cassoulet. So that's how it started. And then everybody started saying, well, if Chez Panisse is serving it, if Stars is serving it, we should have it available for the public. That's how it happened.
You know what I've been noticing is that a lot of this started with people from the East. Alice Waters came from the East. You came from the East. I think Mark Miller came from the East. And then they come out there and they start experimenting and looking at food. Before you know it, it started showing up in your restaurants.
Well, my ending up in California was a completely mistake. I had $25 and I was broke. So I took the first job offer that came along, which was as chef of Chez Panisse, which shows you how desperate they were and how desperate I was. If I'd known what it was like to be a chef, I would have run a mile. Anyway, I was on my way to Hawaii and ended up in Berkeley.
So if in those early years, and you were at Chez Panisse for, what, 7-8 years? Or?
Until, yes. Yeah.
Seven, eight years. And in between, you came to the conclusion that you were going to be opening, you'd open your own restaurant? It wasn't Stars at first. What was it that...
No, I sold my shares in Chez Panisse in 1978 and then went and opened the Santa Fe Bar and Grill, also in Berkeley, while I was looking for money and the means to open Stars in San Francisco.
But back then you were in the kitchen at Chez Panisse then. How did you start finding these farmers, these early days of California cuisine?
Well, I mean, people spread the word. As I said, one day a guy, a sort of aged hippie, came in and said, I have a basket of mushrooms. And I looked at them and I said, well, you've got to tell me which ones are poisonous and which ones are edible. And he said, no, they were chanterelle. I'd never seen a chanterelle before in my life. And so then he spread the word. Then a guy brought mussels. And then a guy brought in from farms in Sacramento and that, through Daryl Cordy, saying, you should all go talk to this chef at Chez Panisse in Berkeley. He'll buy anything from you that's fresh and wonderful. Because let's face it, it's all about ingredients. Always has been and always will be.
So at what time did this start to be referred to as California cuisine?
In 1983, from the Santa Fe Bar and Grill, we did a lunch for 100 food journalists in Rhode Island. And after that, I mean, we were just the side event, the lunch, the California kids. And the big event was the French in the evening. But the journalists all loved what we did. We were grilling the dessert on charcoal and stuff like that. So they said, okay, this is now California cuisine. That was the first time in 1983. And then a month later, we did a big dinner in San Francisco with chefs from all around the United States. And then the journalist said, oh, this is new American cuisine. So in the first quarter of 1983, those two terms were created by journalists.
You know, as it became new American cuisine, it seems to me that regions are now becoming proud of what they have to offer and finding themselves in that tent, aren't they? I mean, the American cuisine allows people to discover the New South or the New Southwestern or something like that. That's kind of authentic and has their own local face to it.
Well, at the Santa Fe Bar and Grill, I started doing festivals of the regions of America, and we did a Florida dinner. And there was a woman from Metropolitan Home came in and said, is this really Florida food? Florida cuisine? I said, I don't know, but with your help, it will be, you know. So it's when the journalists started writing about it, because that the massive food journalism didn't really start until 1982 or something, you know.
So when you get started and you started getting these relationships with the farms that could bring you fresh and local and special, and then did you have other chefs that were copying you and say, Jeremiah, how do you do this? Or did they just try to copy it and work it on their own?
Writers like James Beard said to him, and he had, I don't know how many columns throughout the United States in his weekly food column, but he said, if any young chefs out there, you should look at this restaurant called Chez Panisse. He said, you know, I have four favorite restaurants in the United States. Three of them were the old-fashioned, the ones that everybody knew. And then he said, and this little restaurant in Berkeley called Chez Panisse. And everybody went, what? Berkeley? Chez Panisse? You know. So he made us famous, and then everybody started doing whatever we were doing.
When you got Stars going, you were taking it up quite a bit, because Stars seated a lot more people than Chez Panisse. It was a, right off the bat, it was a pretty good-sized restaurant, right?
Well, yes. I mean, Chez Panisse was like a string quartet, and Stars was like a grand opera.
Yeah, I thought, yeah. A couple levels that you walk into the big room.
And we served probably 1,000 people a day.
And it was all special. I've had some of those meals, and it was very, very special.
The menu changed every day at lunch and dinner. Twice a day, new menus.
So,
it was wild.
So that whole role of changing the menu every single day, when were you finding out what was really best from the farmers that could go into your thinking of what you were going to be putting on the menu?
Well, they were used to me calling them Chez Panisse, and then the faxes. In those days, there were fax machines. The fax would start running at about 8 o'clock at night from all the farmers saying, this is what we've got. This is what we're sending into Greenleaf. This is what we're sending, you know, Starwood Farms would say, this is what we can deliver to you tomorrow morning. So then we would just sit there at midnight and answer the faxes. Food would come in the morning.
You know, at that time, they still weren't putting blackboards up describing the farm. And people knew, I don't believe it was part of the merchandising as much as it is today, of describing the name of the farm and telling a story on the menu.
Well, according to Anthony Bourdain, the first time that ever happened was my California regional dinner in 1976 at Chez Panisse, the one that caught everybody's imagination. And the menu was in English, and we named the farms and used only California wines. But I hate to destroy the myth, but the truth of that is that when the Four Seasons restaurant opened in New York, they were naming the farms. They actually had, they would serve great big beefsteak tomatoes from a certain farm in New Jersey, name the farm, and they'd bring that tomato butt to the table, and they would carve it tableside and dress it there. I don't think anybody's got the nerve to do that today.
What an exciting... The trend today is to maybe get smaller. Can I think of your friend, Chef Mark Miller?
Right.
Mark Miller says that the ideal is if the chef could have only like 10 seats in the restaurant and do everything himself and not have to pay rent and be able to make a good living at it, but just make everything very special. But it's almost like Tiny House Nation for chefs, you know? It's a kind of... It is difficult to do on a large scale the kinds of things that you're trying to do with.
Well, you know, Mark Miller never did that.
Oh, I know he did. Yeah,
he had a restaurant in Santa Fe, a restaurant in Washington D.C. But you know, the French model of, you know, the mother-in-law at the cashier, the wife in the kitchen, and the husband in the kitchen and the dining room. That trio is the magic formula and one restaurant, and then you can do whatever you want. New food every day. I opened other restaurants because that was a mistake. You know, I wasn't smart enough to know I shouldn't do that. Well, one of the reasons I expanded was because they were going to tear down the location where Stars was. So I moved on out, and then they didn't tear it down until right now. They're tearing it down all these years later. But some people have the talent to have multiple properties. I never did. Danny Meyer in New York, you know, is a genius at that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think that you've gone through several stages. I mean, you did the Chez Panisse, you did Stars. The journey that you've been on, making these moves, which included trying to get Tavern on the Green back to what it was in years past.
My journey was to make as much money as possible in the shortest amount of time so that I could just go to the beach. You know, you're working 90 hours a week in a restaurant, carrying the whole load because it's your restaurant. All you can think of is, I'd rather be in Jamaica. You know, I'd rather be scuba diving in wherever it is. That doesn't stop you from working. But so I took Tavern on the Green because it was the ultimate challenge. It was the job that nobody could do. And guess what? They were right. We turned it around, as you can see in the movie that Tony Bourdain did of me. And the staff said, we nearly turned it around. But the owners were real jerks. And so everybody quit. One of the owners, who was the chef partner, came to me one day and said, is it true that lamb has both white and dark meat? And I said, only if it has feathers. And they got really annoyed at me.
Tavern on the Green was a beautiful restaurant. Still is a beautiful building. And it, right on Central Park. And I have fond memories of being able to go there
have,
you know, the brunch, you know, 30 years ago. It was just outstanding. Great, great setting. And that's the other thing that I think that people note about everything you get involved with. There is a sense of, I don't know if I should say theater, but there's the whole thing. There is this wonderful food, sourced as we've described it, and a plate that is beautiful. And the service is almost like you have it, it's been choreographed, because everybody is very, very nice, professional, they're just right on the service. Everything is just right. But the environment, too, the setting, the room, is something that's memorable as much as the food is. That seems to be something, too, that drives you, this, to create that.
Well, you know, a great restaurant would be like giving a great dinner party. So it's balance. The lighting, the flowers, the food, the china, glasses, even if just from the Crate and Barrel, you know, you can do a great table with cheap uplights and Crate and Barrel. It doesn't have to be Baccarat and Sèvres. So to me, it's just all a balance. If you don't have good food, good services, superb service is not going to make up for it. I mean, I think you can go into a hamburger joint, and if it's really all balanced and the same, it's just as... Okay, say, every morning in Mexico, I have my morning tacos at a taco joint. And I take very chic New Yorkers there, and they see the people digging in their hands, making the lechon or pig's feet tacos, and they turn white. You know, I said, just put it in your mouth, for heaven's sakes, you know. And then they put it in their mouth and go, oh, my God. And I said, now, you just had as much satisfaction as a $350 lunch at Le Bernardin. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter. As long as it's good and the setting is equal to the food, absolutely.
You know, you said something magic there, too, and that satisfaction, that you could find it at some of the food trucks that are here today.
Yeah. And, you know, when that little bell goes off in your head, and you know you've got something wonderful.
You know, I'm wondering that over the years, some of the famous people that you have fed, that you might have seen that satisfaction, who are some of the folks that you've been able to feed over the years?
Well, Barbara Streisand came in with Sophia Loren. And they were having lunch, and they invited me over at the end of lunch to go sit with them. And so I sat between them, and I spent the whole time looking to see if they had scars, for, you know, because they look absolutely fabulous. Two of the best pair of breasts in the whole world, faces, absolutely most beautiful, sexy women, and there was no sign of surgery at all. And I finally, we had several bottles of champagne, and I finally got the courage to say, how do you look so great? Sophia said, eating pasta. And I thought, well, that's a great line, but untrue. And Barbara Streisand said, I don't ever eat or drink anything, after her third bottle of champagne. Pavarotti was amazing. It took him 4 or 5 places in the restaurant. He said, no, there's a draft. I finally brought him a napkin, tied 4 corners, and put it on top of his head, and he was happy. There are lots of stories, but my favorite is the naked homeless streaker who came running through Stars one night. We were packed. It was a Friday night. And that could turn into a disaster. Everyone would be upset. So he was running through the bar, and I was standing there, and I stopped him. And I said, get this man a glass of champagne. You know, and the waiter brought it over. The guy was so scared, he just ran out. but the whole restaurant stood up and clapped. They thought that was wonderful.
Now, did you also have to host some political events? It's the people running for presidents or governors or any of those folks too at your restaurants as well? We don't need to get into politics. It's getting close to that season.
No, I mean, it's good. We had Nancy Reagan and the president in one time. Complete pain in the ass because of the days and days of Secret Service. But, you know, Dianne Feinstein and Willie Brown, they all were, that was their local with stars because it was a block away from where they worked. No. So that was fun. I opened it in that location because I thought the politicians would, you know, try and sell us down the river every day at lunch. And the lawyers, because if they lost a case, they'd be sad and come and drink. And if they won a case, they'd be happy and come and drink. It worked out beautifully. It was a great location.
Yeah. So when you left town and you've had these other adventures, you've ended up in Mexico. Why did you go to Mexico?
Well, Tony Bourdain was the only one who understood why I left. I mean, for me to sit there in San Francisco after selling stars, and then it would be like, oh, what's Jeremiah doing next? I mean, to sit around and be sad?
Yeah.
No, I just thought I'd go to the beach. Tony understood that completely. So I just took off from Mexico. Well, it wasn't quite like that. I went to New Orleans, first to New York and then New Orleans, and then Katrina hit, and I was on Cozumel. And so the news came through about Katrina and what happened to New Orleans. And I thought to myself, I'm homeless. I lost 90% of everything I earned, including house. And I thought, well, I'm homeless. 40 margaritas later, I thought, why not? I'm on a tropical island. What better place to be when you're homeless? So I stayed.
So you're on a beach?
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you get out on the beach often?
I scuba dive about a week. Every 6 weeks.
Oh, well, I mean, this is you accomplishing. That's one of the things that was on a bucket list of sorts.
Yes.
You kept saying that I'm doing this so I could go be on a beach, and you're on a beach. You're not on a beach now. Look at this. Hi, everybody. Here we are again. And right here in Sacramento, Jeremiah, again, we have to point out this beautiful dome of the State Capitol building. And the people that can't see this on a podcast, there's something like 80,000 people are coming here celebrating Farm to Fork. Every time I stop and look that direction, I'm just amazed.
And look at that light on the Capitol. It's absolutely beautiful. And a beautiful day here in Sacramento. And the fire, the grilling over there smells like a Mexican beach.
Well, you know what? You should just stay here. You've lived on a beach. You've been there. You lived on a beach. You haven't lived in Sacramento yet.
Now it's time to come back to perfect ingredients. I was so in love with that farmer's market I saw the other day. I just wanted to immediately rent a place here and start cooking.
Well, you're doing some heavy lifting here, too. You're actually kind of organizing this dinner. Did you and chefs here come up with the menu for this dinner?
We all met, you know, several months ago and in Sacramento, and we came up with the menu, and I've kind of, you know, put my oars into that event, to that effort. And yesterday, I peeled with some help 880 tomatoes. You know, I haven't done prep in decades, let alone in that quantity. I had an Ecuadorian prep crew that did all that and made me look good. So yesterday I saw this, one of the, Kathy Riley was looking at those tomatoes and she was like staggered. And I said, I'll jump in and do that. So we did that. And I thought, fine, I'll go back to the pool. And somebody brought in 100 pounds of grapes that had to be stemmed.
You didn't have to peel them.
No, my grandmother would have done that, but I don't peel grapes.
Okay. Did you start off with looking at all that could be available fresh right now within in the region?
Yes. We went through a whole list of all what was available, what would be the best fresh right now and in season. And I also said, because Daryl Cordy showed me sterling, and I didn't realize that Sacramento was the caviar and sturgeon capital of the world or the United States.
Hardly anybody would. I know. It's a surprise.
I went up there, and they showed me how to make caviar, which I vaguely knew, but I was amazed at what they were doing. We got to eat the caviar, and I watched the carving up of the sturgeon. I was just fascinated. So I said, guys, they wanted to do salmon. I said, no. We have to do sturgeon. And we're going to serve it with caviar. So 20 kilos of caviar arrived yesterday morning. And it's a sauce for the smoked sturgeon.
It is incredible. Nobody would expect to find caviar here like that.
They called a few days ago and said, did you really say 20 kilos? I said, absolutely.
So what about the proteins? What are the proteins that are in the meal you've chosen?
So there's the smoked sturgeon, and then duck, roasted duck breast, and the duck leg and thigh confit, and then a braised shoulder of lamb, so that it's the shoulder, because you can cook it a long time and it gets very tender.
Yeah.
And should be not overcooked, but not served rare or medium rare.
Right.
So at the table, family style, you can just take a spoon and get your portion of lamb. And then there's a ricotage, which I have never heard of until I came here, is this amazing white cheese that we're going to serve with peaches and endive salad, all from a few minutes' drive away. Well, not a few minutes, but at least an hour drive around from here.
Oh, that's going to be exciting.
And serve family style down the length of the table for 850 people.
What a fantastic dinner. And a fantastic experience, I think, for the people that are the other chefs, what they're doing, and the farmers that are seeing their foods that are featured in this celebration.
Right. This is a celebration of the farmers and the suppliers. When I say farmers, I mean, you know, fish and ducks, as well as vegetables and fruit. So it's a celebration of them, this dinner. And I've learned so much. You know, I love the food in the Yucatan, in Mexico, but this just blows my mind.
You know, I think the other people that would be learning something is the people that get to work elbow to elbow with you and see that you're not above prepping and working on tomatoes either.
Or the 200 or the 100 pounds of grapes. Either. That one, the one that really got me. After about 2 hours of stemming the grapes, my hand just went like that and wouldn't move anymore. And that's when they said, Chef, why don't you go back to the pool?
There's some people out here. You got some fans here, I know. I'm going to give you a chance to ask some questions. Does anybody have a question? And I see Bobbin Mulvaney has a question. And Alec Wasson has a microphone.
Chef Towers, thank you so much for being here in Sacramento. And as a young chef, you were so inspiring to me before we ever met. Your style, I followed you. I saved my money to eat in your places. I was able to meet you at Starves. And you were so inspiring to me as a young woman chef, just to be kind and to talk to me and telling me to keep up the good work. And I just always kept that you were so encouraging of young women. And I could see in your kitchen. Is there anything that you can say to the young women coming up in our industry now, 40, 35 years later? You know, we in without bringing up bad topics of Me Too, you know how tough kitchens can be. But I'm hoping that you can continue inspiring younger women.
Well, I was the first person in San Francisco to put women as bartenders. And I put them on the line with all those 22-year-old testosterone-driven line cooks, you know. So I made everybody equal. I was just at a symposium in New Orleans at Commander's Palace for its 125th anniversary. At one end of there was a woman's panel about exactly that. At one end was Leah Chase, 96 years old, you know, with that fried chicken restaurant. She's the queen of New Orleans. And at the other end was Dominique Crenn. And Dominique Crenn from San Francisco. And everyone was talking about that exact thing. So Dominique said, everybody just stop whining and be yourself and let's move on. Leah Chase said, at 96, she's had a restaurant for 70 years. She said, you know, men are just useless, but we need them to do certain things. If they bother you, just kick them in the balls and get on with your work. The whole room stood up and screamed.
Wise advice. What do you have to say to the farmers that are trying to gear up? And how do we keep this thing going?
Well, I don't think the demand for perfect ingredients will stop anytime soon. As long as everybody remembers that perfect agriculture is what keeps us alive. You know, without great ingredients, life will stop. And California has certainly set the standard for how to keep this going. You know, it used to be that you bought from, I forgot the Safeway. Now you've got a choice of all the most beautiful, healthy, supportable ingredients, and that's what's important. Without perfect agriculture, life will stop.
We are so fortunate that you've come here. I have to add one personal story, and that is, until 6 months ago, we lived on the beach, and we moved to Sacramento, so it can be done.
I'll be right behind you.
Oh, good, good. I know people would welcome having you in town.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this is it's so great what you're doing. We appreciate your leadership. We appreciate your being part of this whole event, and we want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much.